Okay, you're very welcome back to the programme. Delighted to welcome back onto it for dear Greg Keeley Taverna, psychotherapist, author and coach. Great to see you again. How are you keeping?
Always a pleasure to see you, Greg. Always a pleasure.
Great to have you back on the show, and you're looking fabulous, I must say. Can you say that in 2023?
I try. Absolutely, you need to. People need compliments out here.
Okay, that's good. All right, well, I'm your man. Right, okay, come here. We'll get into some questions straight away. There's a slight delay on the line, but the connection will pick up because Zoom will sort that out for us. So I'll ask a question and just let you go. My partner has a hard time expressing their feelings. It's causing problems in our relationship. How can I get them to open up more to me? So there are obviously two different types of people, it sounds like. I don't know, Katie's frozen altogether. I'm going to kick her out and bring her back in then, I think, because that looks like it's not going to rectify. Right, Katie, are you there?
Some sort of stereotypes about men.
Katie, just 1 second till we this sorts itself out, and then you can go into answering the question now, I think. I think we're back connected again.
Okay, better?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so one of the challenges around that can be, you know, generally, I'm assuming it's a male, that generally men aren't great at talking about their feelings, which is, if that's kind of the kind of general ethos. I think I've said before, sometimes there's a benefit to actually considering whether you might benefit from, you know, I've spoke about conversation cards before, so we can have conversations when we're in the car. Because it's not easy, you know, what might be an alternative way to be able to have the conversation that circumnavigates any resistance or pushback. So you try to create the optimal conditions, but I think it's something that you have to be conscious of as a relationship dynamic, because it's important to have that two-way process going on.
But just kidding, so, in relation to that, like, say, for instance, one person might be emotionally needy and the other is just the type of person that's not necessarily very, very expressive. I mean, there's two people involved in that as well, you know, and you don't want someone else to change just to make you feel that you're getting all you need from a feelings perspective.
Absolutely. So there's a benefit to also, if you're a needy person, you have to also check yourself, look into yourself. What is that about? Because sometimes we do place disproportionate expectations on our partner. So you also have to have a certain amount of awareness about, well, you know, is it excessive? Are my needs excessive? That takes some self-awareness. And as ever, that may mean we may benefit from therapy in order to work out what's been going on for us. But I guess there's a place to meet in the middle, which is about compromise. Some people aren't great at words, but they may find other ways to express themselves through song, sometimes through writing, through actions. This also taps into people's love languages. So for some people, that is going to be about, you know, acts of service, communication, or aspects that are important. But also, you know, in terms of your own, you know, your own preferences. And that's where we experience a clash, whether it's with same-sex relationships or not. But, you know, endeavouring to start a communication. Mm. Like I said, conversation cards can be one way. It's not the only way. But there is a benefit to seeing where there is room for compromise.
And I presume, is it okay for people not to share everything, elements about them, maybe how they think, or if they suffer from anxiety or what have you, that they want to deal with it themselves? They don't want necessarily to share it with a partner because they might feel they've got a lovely partner, but they simply won't get it.
Absolutely. Often, you know, throughout the years, I have clients and they share every aspect of what they've done in therapy with their partner. And sometimes that can be helpful and unhelpful. We are entitled to our own private lives and to share minimally if we choose to. How that impacts on the other person is a dynamic you'll have to encounter and hopefully work through or not. But there's a massive benefit to looking inwards. Sometimes as a therapist, I think sometimes my recommendations are always about therapy, but there's a benefit that, you know, if you are needy, also checking that out, because it can mean that we place a disproportionate expectation, but also expect somebody else to be emotionally articulate, and they may well not be.
Mm. And I suppose we have to find our own place in the world, and not sort of do it as a reference point to somebody else. And you know, a conversation might reassure that person that they can have a happy relationship, but their partner doesn't have to tell them absolutely everything that they're feeling at any given time, or that they love them all of the time.
Absolutely. And that is about, and the challenge is when it becomes a demand, it's not a healthy place for the relationship to evolve into. That's when it becomes arduous and difficult and hard. So there's a benefit to checking, you know, if you're someone who's insecure and perpetually needs reassurance, then that might be something that you need to work on as an individual. But, you know, I often recommend to people to watch couples therapy, which is a show which documents real relationships and live therapy. So you can get an example of the dynamics that can come up between couples. But ultimately, if somebody's not open and articulate about how they feel, and they don't have a problem with it, and it's not something that they want to work on, then unfortunately, that is the reality of your situation. But sometimes, you know, a person will get to a point where they realize, actually, it's not only hindering me in this relationship, it hinders me in other aspects of my life.
I don't want my partner snooping through my phone. I think it's disrespectful. She thinks it's suspicious. I've got nothing to hide, but it's become a real bone of contention. I feel I look like the bad guy here.
Snooping through someone's phone is a breach of, can be a breach of trust. I mean, the reality is, you know, it's not like we've got these Nokia phones from the 90s. All aspects of our lives can be traced through our phone. And people have are entitled to not give you their phone, their passwords, for you to have free access. And if you are tired of somebody going through your phone, you're entitled to feel that way. You don't have to give over your device. If you choose to, that's your choice.
But it's very suspicious looking.
But be mindful, because what is that about? I'd be curious about, is that because that person's insecure and they need perpetual reassurance so they can feel reassured if you're open about your phone? I don't know about you, but personally, if someone, a partner asked to see my phone, I wouldn't be best pleased, and be more curious about what that need is within them.
And is that how you'd flip it back in them? Would you say, look, because you could be keeping a diary in your notes, you could be searching stuff that's personal to you, whatever it might be. Do you flip it back then? Do you say, look, principally, I've nothing to hide on this device, but I'm very curious as to why you want access to my advice. Is that how you'd flip it back the other direction?
Ultimately, yeah, because it's about trust. And if there's a trust issue in the relationship, what is that about? What do they hope to gain from my phone that will reassure them? Because, for example, if I was speaking to somebody else or potential, I don't know, love recruit, I can disguise their name as something else. I could call them Beverly Jones to circumnavigate any potential problems. So, you know, sometimes if you're looking for something, you can find things. But we are entitled to our own privacy. I'm a firm believer of that.
My partner and I come from different cultural backgrounds, and our families don't get along. Can we make our relationship work?
Always reminds me of Meghan and Harry.
Yeah.
Different cultural background.
Like, it's not really that, but it's that.
You've got to be realistic about it.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. You're going to have different values, different cultures, different customs, and sometimes that is an added dimension in the relationship that can wear a relationship down over time. I think what's key is your communication about that, to be open about that, and try to work out ways to support and assist each other You know, and sometimes that may mean you may not want to go to the family christenings, bar mitzvahs, weddings, and so forth. And how your partner, you know, may receive that.
This has come up a couple of times in the past, Kitty, and it's the one, and I might be reading you completely wrong. I think it's the one issue that you perhaps feels one of the more difficult to overcome because of the level of sacrifice that both partners might have to give and the pressure that would put on any relationship, as strong as it might be, and also how healthy, even if you did find a way to not have interaction with your other half's family or for it to be muted or arranged, is that really any way to live your life? Now, I could be reading you completely wrong, but it's just, it's come up a couple of times, and this sounds to me like it's one of the more difficult circles to square when we're asking relationship questions.
It's a complex matter, but it also depends, because you've also got power dynamics, right, as well. In some instances you have, if certain families will fund and support you to do certain things if you work for your family. So it's all unique and individual. But also the partners also have to communicate with their family about appropriateness and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. So it's not just, you know, both parties have to be able to communicate with their families too, to make their families aware of, you know, comments about race, class, you know, that it's not appropriate. So it's difficult to navigate, and it's unique to every couple that come together. Meghan and Harry are just a kind of popular example to refer to when the culture clashes.
But the only way they have been able to make that work is for him to effectively completely disengage with his family.
Which comes at a high price. That comes at a high price. And that's what some people have to do. I've worked with a whole raft of cross-cultural relationships. In some relationships, some families will abandon you. I've had an Indian client who had a black male partner, and she was ostracized by her family because it was unacceptable. So sometimes there's not even choice about that. And that weighs heavily on the relationship, also can create isolation and a longing for and a yearning for one's own family. So it's a massive dynamic to consider. And when you add factors like religion as well, you know, it's workable, but there's something that needs to be solid within the relationship.
But then you have children, and then it's not just decisions you make for yourself. It's the decisions about whether that could complicate access to wider family and grandparents. It is so complex. A caller says, my partner keeps siding with his mother over me on silly things. I feel like there are jokes too at my expense. I think he's going to propose soon. Sorry, it's just that it just sounds like the person doesn't know what to do. But at what point will it be on my team? Will he be on my team instead? So it feels like you're siding with his mom. Jokes in front of the family, I presume at them expense, at her expense or his expense. I think it's a her. And he might be getting down on one knee soon. So, you know, they want to know, will he be on team her at any time soon?
These are really important dynamics to pay attention to, because if you're dating a mama's boy, then the reality is that is likely to be a dynamic moving forward. There's value in having the conversation with your partner about your irritations, be able to back that up with examples and see where that takes you. If they go into denial, they don't know what you're talking about, or why do you look at it like that, then that's really unfortunate, because it means it's some place that they're not prepared to look at. They're not prepared to look critically at their behavior. So it's very frustrating and unhelpful. And I think it's about setting your boundaries about things not being acceptable. And if it feels too uncomfortable, then you need to think about what best you do to either avoid or circumnavigate those situations.
And now's the time, isn't it? Because one could get caught up in the whole proposal. Next thing, everyone's planning weddings. You can't really pay attention to all of that. Then you're under the same roof, married, and the problems are still there. Now, whilst they have this foresight. Absolutely. Now is the time really to test the waters, I think, yeah?
Absolutely. Have the dialogue.
Is there anything to suggest that that person who's a mommy's boy, as you describe, would then start maybe, if they have children, siding with the children over his partner? Or is it perhaps a dynamic in the relationship he has with his mother?
Well, I guess it depends. You'd have to work out whether when they're in crowd, they have a desire to people please. So it doesn't mean it's a prerequisite for how they'll be when they're a parent. But it is a dynamic to pay attention to, because that can be undermining, it can be humiliating and embarrassing. So for now, I'd rather think about it in isolation. Doesn't necessarily mean that if you had children, they would. But it may mean that you may find his behavior distasteful around his mother, and that can build resentment, and is something that is best dead in the present rather than later, because it will only continue.
Yeah, I think to some extent, whilst they might have difficult conversations to have, they're in a better position than considering this down the line. My partner, this is the last one we've time for, Kayleigh, I know where you're very busy as well. My partner wants a baby. It's not that I don't want a baby with them, but I feel we aren't really ready financially, and I don't know what to do about this situation.
Well, some argue that there's never a right time to have a baby, that there's never enough money, it's never the right time. I think, as ever, you need to communicate about where you're at and the fact that you're coming from different places in terms of child, you know, when you both want children. That's an important dialogue to have. And I don't know, I'm a believer, maybe this sounds naive, but there's always a way to be found. There's never a perfect time. And obviously, as women, we have to be mindful, you know, of our age. And I think there is many challenges in our times with people wanting to pursue careers, get the job, get the house. And that is totally understandable. We have a biological clock. But I think it's important to start having the dialogue, talk about it, and talk about what your timeframes are.
Do you think that person really needs to ask themselves, is it about the money? Because maybe then if they get good jobs, they might say, well, we really want a house, or we need a long lease somewhere before we can have a family. And then if that's, then well, we have to do the house up. Like, do you think that person needs to look inwards and say, really, is this about whether or not you can afford nappies and milk? You know, it's tough, right? But for most, it's manageable because you're not going out.
Definitely. And the reality is, and like you said, you could get hooked on the money and the money be an issue. But actually, is there something underneath that? So my question would be, put money aside and, you know, think about what are your timeframes? What are the timeframes that would be ideal for you? And that just separates the money from, you know, in terms of your own desires, in terms of when you want to become a mother, so that you have an idea and then begin to communicate. Because clearly it's not just about money. It's also about that person doesn't feel that they're ready yet.
Yeah.
When do they think?
Well, see, that's it. And that's what they need to be really careful about. Thank you so much for your time again today. We really do appreciate it, Kayleigh. And you do work with individuals, with couples, and just like we've done it now, it's very easy to do it remotely, and sometimes actually maybe it's even better. So if anyone has any issues that they wish to contact Kayleigh about, give us the contacts again, Kayleigh, please.
So you can find me at keyforchange.com.
And you're so clever, you spelt it both ways, so you don't even have to clarify what we're talking about.
Exactly.
Thanks so very much indeed. You're in London, aren't you? It's lovely and warm. We were over there at the weekend roasting.
Absolutely. Hydration time. Keep that water going
now. All right, Kayleigh. Thank you so very much. Take care of yourself. Families of those killed during the Troubles say the passing of the British government's legacy bill marks a dark day for justice. Despite widespread opposition, it's cleared the UK House of Commons and is now on the verge of becoming law. The bill will effectively end prosecutions linked to past violence and stop new cases and inquests being opened. And there are two parties in favour of this, it seems, the Tory party and at least some of the army veterans. Everybody else everybody else strongly opposed to this. Senator Niall Blaney joins us now. Senator, good morning to you. Again, well, why do you think the Conservative government is pushing this through the way they have?
Well, it said, Greg, that they made a promise to veterans, and apparently there's quite a lot of veterans in the UK, and a lot of them, not a lot of them, but there are some key people within the Conservative Party, and they got a promise back from Boris Johnson when he was PM, that this would be the approach. It's a reckless approach. We've been over it all before. It's the one thing in this island across North and South that every party in Ireland agrees on. This is the wrong approach. There was a new decade approach agreed by all parties when they were sitting in Stormont. New decade, new approach. There was a strategy in dealing with all of this. And British government have now moved unilaterally against everybody's wishes. And it's reckless in the extreme, to say the least. And I suppose the next steps, Greg, is pushing our own government, and I don't expect to get much pushback, if any. I expect to see the Irish government take a case to the European Court of Justice.
And I'm sure victims to undo it. Sorry, I beg your pardon, Al. I'm sure victims will as well, because I can only imagine what it must feel like when you've been campaigning for justice for as long as many of these families have, to be told then, well, I'm sorry, there is no justice. The murder effectively didn't happen in the eyes of law and order. I mean, what kind of a civilization would want to stand over that, where you throw families under the bus in that way?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm just waiting a call from Grainne Taggart. Grainne is probably the senior citizen of Northern Ireland for Amnesty International. And I suppose Grainne's claim to fame, her most recent claim to fame, she was the one that led the case in relation to Aidan McInnesby and the investigation of the shooting of Aidan by a British soldier. And they got their answers earlier on this year. And there are many, many other cases that are ongoing where people are seeking justice, but this would take an end to all that. And it does nothing to help the healing of the past. It actually acts against the wishes of those most affected that lost loved ones. There's no way to move forward a peace process. It's reckless and extreme.
And as I said earlier, Senator, you know, the majority, or at least an awful lot of the victims, they weren't members of any organisations. They weren't Crown Forces. They were completely innocent civilians. And now
the innocent victims that can't move on, Greg, they can't get answers. This trauma is becoming generationalised. It's moving from generation to generation until it's dealt with. The peace process can't move on at the pace that United would like to see it. And the British government acting like this at a time when parties are not meeting and sitting in Stormont, it is really as reckless in the extreme.
And also the argument being put across that in some way people might now come forward with information and that can be sorted out through inquests and what have you, especially given that this is going to be challenged and delay that process. But to suggest that all of a sudden the floodgates of information would start opening, I think that's actually even also a further insult to families who know that that's completely
absolutely. I sat on three occasions with Lord Jonathan Keane, who's led this on behalf of the British government, since September of last year, and he's pushing this argument. You know, those people could have come forward other amnesties under the Good Friday Agreement. It hasn't happened. There are parties on all sides on different investigations that don't want truth uncovered. These investigations are not easy, and that's why they've been taking so many years to resolve some of them, and some of them are still outstanding. And there are some of them that are well down the road. But for now, say to them, when you are so far down the road, that when you're getting somewhere, that now it's all to an end and was all worthless and nothing. It's an awful kick in the teeth for across Northern Ireland.
Okay, thanks for your time this morning. I do appreciate it. That's Senator Niall Blaney just reacting to that news. Let's take a couple of comments here. I had to cancel an appointment for speech therapy due to a family bereavement. I did it via voicemail. This is the system that's in place. Months had passed. We didn't get a follow-up. We then received a letter because we missed the appointment to say he was off the list. We're now on a waiting list again. What's the point in a voicemail if it does not work? And similar to appointments and deferring and cancelling appointments, I had another contact from a listener via social media, and I promised that I would give that an airing as well. But the email's been very busy at the moment, so if not, I can... Yeah, here it is. I phoned the hospital, as have problems, so I need to see my surgeon. I was told you didn't reply to the last letter, which I know I did. So I was put through to the appointments. Well, oh my God, she was very cheeky, didn't ask my name, and says, yes, the letter was returned. I said I emailed as well. That's what's wrong, she says, and someone who's higher than me will call you. I'm in a lot of pain and don't know what to do, Greg. So there's... the letter was returned, was not returned, sorry. She said the letter, so the second person they went through says, you didn't return the letter. But we have a listener here waiting for an appointment who says, yes, I did return the letter. And now they're in pain and are being called effectively a liar as well. And that's sort of the system there. Back to on greening of Alia. My partner took the children up last Saturday and the gates were closed at around 5:15. A busload of tourists were there and couldn't get in. It's embarrassing that my partner, a local, couldn't even explain why it wasn't open. Another, I see no reason why people should accept this arrangement at Ungreenon by the OPW. The people should take ownership of their amenity and remove any barriers. If enough people support it, it can't. If enough people don't support it, it can't happen. Good morning, Greg. I know that every little bit of a reduction in electricity bills is good, but there are no reductions in the standing charges. And that's another point being made by another listener. They went up 100%. And just before the break, a little announcement here. Greg, please read out that the table quiz in Burt tonight, Thursday, has been postponed. That comes in from Kathleen. So if you were planning to go to that table quiz in Burt tonight, it has been postponed. And I'm sure you'll be able to find out a later date when that has been rescheduled. We were chatting about sleeping and a new study out looking at our sleep patterns. And I'm so bloody average. I got a notification from a watch on the phone there saying last night I slept slept 6 hours, 20 minutes. And apparently the average Irish person sleeps for 6 hours, 22 minutes. So I'm spot on. Anyway, Anne-Marie Boylan is a sleep expert from the Sleep Care Company. And we're speaking about this study. Good morning to you, Anne-Marie. Really appreciate your time today.
Good morning, Greg. How are you doing?
I am doing good. Right. Okay. So only around about 13% of us, the head hits the pillow and we sleep like babies, although that's always a bit of a misnomer, that. But anyway, the majority of us have issues with our sleep, and sleep is so terribly important, isn't it, Anne-Marie?
It's hugely important. People think that lack of sleep just gives us energy, but actually it gives us so much more, you know, our concentration, how we feel the next day, brain fog, how we perform at work, how cranky we are or not with our colleagues, with our kids. So it's really important. It's one of the three pillars of health alongside nutrition and fitness.
The biggest cohort is the late night scroller. We scroll through social media right up until the time we doze off. About one in three of us do that. That's not the best way to go to sleep, I'm sure.
No, it's not. The late night scrolling is a killer. And actually, as well, the survey, which was conducted by DFS, it also shows that we are 2.5 times more likely to be on our phones at night before bed than our UK colleagues. So there is a big amount of Irish people doing this before they go to bed. And what happens is the blue light from the screens is going to interrupt our melatonin production, which is our sleep hormone. And that's going to basically say to our brains, I'm awake, and it's going to keep us awake or not let us get a good night's sleep.
Yeah, and I think that can be symptomatic of other problems too, because sometimes if, you know, my mind's racing, thinking about things, you sort of occupy yourself with your phone until such time as your eyes simply can't stay open any longer. So it's not necessarily we're fascinated with what's going on in the world of social media. It can be a symptom of other issues that are stopping us get to sleep.
Yeah, and a good tip is to actually ditch the phone before bed. So that would be one of the things that I really suffered from when I had insomnia, was being on the phone. So one thing is to put it away an hour before bed, at least an hour before bed. And if you need to use your alarm clock, then use an old-fashioned alarm clock. Have that beside your bed instead. Because as I say, the blue light is really what's keeping us awake.
One in 10 people waking up frequently through the night to check the time too. That's a disturbed sleep pattern, isn't it? I'm not sure they're that bothered about what the time it is, but they're just having to check and they keep waking up.
Yeah, and it's very frequent. And what happens when you keep checking the time is you might not think it's stressing you out, but it probably is. And can disturb your sleep. For some of us, we can fall back asleep straight away, but for some people, it does stress them out looking at the time and figuring out, okay, I actually don't have much time left to sleep.
I don't think there's anything good about being the snacker, of snacking up to bedtime and even hopping out of bed to get something to eat. I mean, you don't want your digestive system to be working overtime as you're trying to nod off, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's a good statistic. Again, the survey, which was by DFS, showed that the snackers, they are 5% of us. So I would say 3 hours before bed, don't have a heavy meal. It's okay to have a small snack before bed, but preferably not all the way up to bedtime. So we need to give our bodies a break. So no heavy meals 3 hours before bed. But if you are, so let's say you had your dinner at 5 or 6, it is okay to have a small little snack before bed, which helps our blood sugar.
All right. The dancer, the one who's tossing and turning all night, another one in 10. Are they having a bad night's sleep, or is that just the nature of their sleep?
It's just the nature of their sleep. A lot of people toss and turn. I think it's, there were 11%, as you said. I think it's more problematic if you're disturbing someone beside you in the bed. So, you know, might have someone kicking you or hogging the duvet. So just to be considerate of, if you do share a bed with someone, to be considerate of them. So, for example, if there are two people in the bed, have bedside lights for each one and try not to disturb. If one person goes to bed earlier than the other, so there was, they were in the survey as well, the me first, so the person who likes to go to bed first before their partner, there was 8% of people did that. So just to be considerate of the other person. And for a person who does go to bed earlier, if you think you will be disturbed by your partner, then wear an eye mask and perhaps some earplugs.
Also, there's a lot of people, I have been amongst them, that will fall asleep listening to the radio or a podcast or white noise. But I stopped doing so because I do still, but I set a timer to stop it. I stopped doing so because I heard that really you get your best sleep if there's as little amount of noises as possible.
It actually works for some people. So the idea behind it is to have a little sleep routine to program your brain, you know, to get ready for the period of inactivity ahead. So it works different for everyone. So the noise machines work for some people. So that could be the white noise machine, or you could listen to white noise on YouTube, for example, or pink noise is another one that sounds like rainfall that works for some people. For other people, it may be listening to a guided meditation. And for some, it might be listening to a sleep story. So that's somebody famous, for example, like Kate Winslet or Matthew McConaughey, who will talk you through a story to get you to sleep. So it's just about finding that one little thing that relaxes you, and everyone is different. For other people, it could be reading a book before bed. For someone else, it could be having a hot bath or doing some stretches. So it's just about finding your unique sleep routine, and then working with your sleep personality as well, your sleep chronotype.
Yeah, and for marketing purposes, it's fun to sort of identify, am I a 1, 2, 3, 4 and so on. But these are all kind of issues that we want to address, particularly late, like snacking, you know, how we go to sleep, not using our phones. I mean, ideally, we don't want to perpetually identify as one of the 7. We want to be able to be one of the 13% where we're at like a light and sleep well through the night.
Yeah, that's it. It is really around those simple hacks that you can do both leading up to bed and during the day. So during the day, you know, no coffee after 2 o'clock. Coffee or tea is fine in the morning, but after 2, it starts to eat into our sleep drive. So it's going to affect our sleep. So perhaps swap your afternoon cuppa for a decaf or a herbal tea instead, or a decaf coffee. So there's a couple of things you can do. Get sunlight early in the morning, so when you wake up, get sunlight into your eyes within the first hour. That's another hack. And then conversely, in the evening, you're going to limit the light, so make sure you have blackout blinds, dim your light, so you're trying to limit the light as much as possible in the evening. And then, as I said, you can find out your sleep personality to find out whether you're a morning person, an evening person, or somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And that you can go and do a little quiz on the website dfs.co.uk to find out your sleep personality.
Finally, if we've had a shocking experience, but, you know, it could be a car crash, or in this listener's case, their husband passed away. It's 4 years since they passed and they haven't been able to sleep properly since. Is that something that you really need to get to the lumps of it while you're awake, or is there any advice you could give to help them sleep?
Yes, unfortunately, traumas such as a death in the family, or someone, you know, your child might be going off to college, or, you know, big stressful events can cause insomnia in that case. Our nervous system is totally thrown off, so I would... Those sleep hacks wouldn't work for that person. I would recommend that they look to work with someone.
A grief like counsellor or whatever specialist might be most relevant to the situation.
Or a sleep specialist, yeah.
Okay, people can search out the sleep care company to get more information. Anne-Marie is it Boylan or Boyhan?
It's Boyhan.
Boyhan, yeah. Of course, that's what I suspected. Anne-Marie Boyhan is the sleep expert with the sleep care company. As I say, you can search them out for more info. Thank you so much for your time, Anne-Marie. Okay, the number of empty shops and offices across the country is the highest it's been in a decade. A geo-directory report shows the amount of vacant commercial properties around the country rose 0.2% to 14.1%. Donegal had the third highest rate at 17.5%, and Bundoran had the lowest rate in this county, 12.2%. And once again, Ballybuffet, 29.2%. It's the highest in the country. I don't know. We're neck and neck with Shannon, but anyway, we'll dig into that in a second. How do we... Dara Keogh, sorry, is the CEO of Geo Directory. Good morning to you, Dara. So how do we come to these figures then? So, how are the figures compiled?
So, well, good morning to everybody. We create a database, if you like, or a listing of all the buildings in the country, what their address is, what their function is, and that's used by a whole series of our customers. So, for example, if you ring up and want a pizza delivered, they have to find you, and they use our data to find you. Online shopping, same thing. Emergency services, same thing. So that's where we have to, we create this data set of the addresses and what if they're empty or not empty, basically. And so that's one of the features we look at. And in terms of commercial properties, what we're trying to look at here is the real economy and what people experience in their community. So we look at this at a national, provincial, county and town level. And that enables us to sort of say, like, why you might hear figures about growth in the economy and full employment, what you might experience in your community might be very different. Mm-hmm. And these figures give a look at what that might be.
Yeah, okay. And this is not, you can completely correct me, I'm sure you will if I'm completely wrong. But when I started seeing these figures initially, I kind of made a exact comparison to, right, well, there's lots of businesses must have closed in Ballybuffet, or they can't, you know, there's no new businesses going in there. And over time, with the figures as they are, I kind of sort of get the feeling, and as I say, Dara, this is where you correct me if I'm wrong, that annually, or however frequent these reports come out, we're just counting the same stuff over and over again. Like, it's not really pointing to any massive trends in our region anyway, that we're just counting the same amount of vacant properties over and over.
Well, that's not quite true. I can understand why you might feel that way, but it's not quite true. So what we're seeing, for example, in Ballybuffet, just as an example, that its vacancy rate actually fell last year over the last 12 months. So while it's still very high, it is the highest in the country at 29.9, it actually was at 30.2. So there has been an improvement in Ballybuffet. Same way across the whole of Donegal, it was 17.2 vacancy rate in 2022, June 2022. In June 2023, it's 17.9. So that's a 0.7% increase in vacancy rate. And then if you look at maybe some the other big, I suppose, town in the county would be Letterkenny. And its vacancy rate has gone up from 22.6 to 24. So there are movements going on all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So there are definitely changes that happen throughout the year.
Is there a base level, though, of, say, you know, Celtic Tiger building? And I can think of a couple of premises in Ballybuffet that sort of talked this a little bit. There is a sort of a stubborn baseline there still at the same time. And until such time as it's converted to apartments or tossed and houses are built, it's just going to sit there.
Well, there's two parts to that. The first of all is there should be should there be commercial vacancies, and if there should be, what rate should it be at? So over the last 10 years, it looks like somewhere around 10% is a natural level for commercial vacancy. And so that means that there's still 20% that needs to be used, or in and around that figure. And I think policymakers are now looking at commercial premises that have been vacant for a number of years to see can they be reconverted or reused in a residential way. Now, some of this is you might have a shopfront might be fine, but the two buildings above it, or the two apartments above it, not their apartments, they were previous, maybe an accountant's office, a solicitor's office, could be repurposed. They're now empty, but they could be repurposed for residential use. So there is an ongoing debate about how this oversupply in some areas of commercial property can be reconfigured to make it more productive for the area.
Is there a time scale like as to when something had to be in use as a commercial premises? In other words, if are we sure that, as I say, sorry to labour the point, that we're not all counting the same stuff over and over again? Like, should we not be sort of saying, after a certain period of time, maybe there's no intention for this ever to be commercial property? It's just lying there. How are you curating that?
So we make properties, if they're not being maintained, they become derelict. Okay, so this is properties in the sense that there could be units within a building rather than the whole building. So there's just two things going on here. So we have to be conscious of that as well. And we don't have, it doesn't stay vacant forever. It does become derelict after if it comes into disrepair. And it's not an engineering's report on derelict. It's more of man on the street's view of what derelict is. So that building looks like nobody's ever been in it. Never, like it's fallen down. That's derelict.
That's okay? How you judge it, or are you judging it on whether or not it loses its air code? Or
no, it's not based on air codes. It's based on the function of the building. Is it residential or commercial? And then it's based on how long it's been vacant and what's the state of the building.
So just because this is really interesting, then. So let's take Ballard Buffet for an example. How are you making a comparison between last year and this year?
So some of the vacancies would be the same as this year as last year, but Bally Buffet vacancies has come down this year to last year. So some of the vacancies now, it could be that there's new vacancies and some of the old vacancies have
how does your company learn that what was once vacant is now occupied?
Yeah, so we're our data, if you like, is generated through the Tadhg Éireann, which used to be Ordnance Survey Ireland, and on Post. So we rely on the delivery teams within Post to let us know.
That's what I said. That's what I suspected it was, but you kind of moved away from that.
Yeah. So we rely basically
on the activity. It's the activity of the air code. It is the activity of the air code.
An air code can exist whether or not the building is vacant or used or derelict. An air code can be on it. So this is more what's happening in the air code is generated from our data. Okay. So we supply air code with the data that enables them to do their work. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking at here is saying it's not to do so much with the air code, it's to do with the functionality and the use of the building or the dwelling or the unit, depending on how you want
to do it. But the only way you can segregate out multiple offices, floors in a building, is through where the post gets delivered, no?
Yeah, so we have a unique identity on every.
Yeah, that's what I suspect.
Separate from an air code, it's a database code, mm-hmm, that we have that enables us to identify each unit within a building, and what the function of that unit is.
So, how robust do you think this directory is?
Very robust. I'm going to say that clearly, but it is. No, we have it. We obviously have a whole series of customers who use it, continue to use this, and give us feedback on it. So we believe that it's very strong. It's never perfect because it's always historical, because we go into an area today, we leave it tomorrow, and things change. So we're always trying to catch up. But as in terms of a very good overview, I think it is a very good overview, and definitely in terms of providing a very strong trend line, it does that as well.
And just very finally, if a solicitor's office closes and Argos closes, how are you... where are the percentages there? Obviously, one's going to have a tiny floor space compared to the other.
Yeah, so we don't measure this report. It doesn't measure square footage. We have square footage, but we don't include it in this report. So it's just a unit. Every unit is treated as the same. It's a unit of economic activity, and the effect is, from a commercial point of view, is that there's less economic activity. Now, what I have to say is there has been
changes. There's a lot of stuff working at home. Exactly.
So there has been changes. And that's partly why we might see an increase in vacancy is that businesses are co-sharing. They're not using the same level of space that they needed before. And then in the retail sector, we're also seeing, which everybody's moving online, or not everybody, but there's an increase in the number of online purchases and also how stores deliver that.
Move into a hub, right? You know these hubs pop up. If those eight businesses vacate their premises and move into a hub, that would not adjust, presumably if they're in the same area, that does not adjust these figures neither up nor down.
Well, if they could do, because if they're in eight separate units and then they move into one unit, then there's eight units vacant in one new unit, which is occupied. So it would increase the vacancy by a number.
Fascinating. Okay, Dara, thank you so much for your time. I just really wanted to learn, understand the figures more, and you've really helped in that regard. Thank you very much indeed. Dara Keogh, CEO of Geo Directory. I think it's really important we start digging into those figures as we just have. Our Thursday Daily winner, Jared Cannon. Well done. He's in New Mills. You're in the draw tomorrow for that 3 months membership to Fit 20. Okay, we're back tomorrow morning at 9. Stay tuned. John Breton's up around the Northwest next. For me, Greg Hughes and Donna Marie and Neve, have a great Thursday.